မနက်ငယ်မှာ Wi-Fi Internet ဝန်ဆောင်မှုတွေကိုနောက်ထပ်တစ်စုံတရာအကြောင်းမကြမချင်းပိတ်ထားရမယ်ဆိုရက်စစ်ကောင်စီရဲ့ညွှန်ကြားချက်ရရှိထားတယ်လို့ Internet ဝန်ဆောင်မှုကုမ္ပဏီတွေကပြောပါတယ်
ကျေရွဆက်သွယ်ရေးရေဒါဆက်သွယ်ရေးနဲ့ရေဒီယိုဆက်သွယ်ရေးပစ္စည်းတွေကိုလိုင်စင်ရယူထားခြင်းမရှိဘဲဝန်ဆောင်မှုပေးတာတက်ဆင်အသုံးပြုတာလုံဝဲထားရှိတာတွေကိုစစ်ဆေးတွေးရှိပါကဆက်သွယ်ရေးဥပဒေ68နဲ့တရားစွဲဆိုအရေးယူမယ်လို့နာဆာကကကြေညာချက်ထုတ်ပြန်ပါတယ်
Before we hear from our upcoming guest, I want to address a sensitive topic that carries horrific implications. It concerns landmines and the well-documented practice of the military to force villagers to walk ahead of soldiers in landmine-contaminated areas, using them indiscriminately as human minesweepers. It goes without saying that this butchery is a grave violation of humanitarian and human rights law. No one should fall victim to these terrible and indiscriminate weapons.Especially children who are among the most vulnerable. But the problem of landmines in Myanmar goes way beyond that. So in response, we will be launching a new series of podcast episodes titled Navigating a Minefield. Each monthly episode will examine landmine issues from diverse perspectives to inform, educate, and inspire action. More information is available on our website, including risk education materials produced by our humanitarian partners, which we encourage listeners to share to promote safety measures for at-risk communities and raise awareness about humanitarian mine action. It's a difficult topic, but a very important one. Thanks for listening, and now let's get on to today's guest.
I'm joined today by Lana from Article 19, and we are going to be discussing predominantly a report dealing with the complicated interaction between the tech sector and governments in particularly repressive Asian states. So before we get into the details of that, Lana, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us today. I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself and your background for our audience.
Hi. Well, first of all, thank you for giving me this great chance to speak out. as we're trying to work within Article 19 on amplifying voices from Asia region. So my name is Lana. I'm leading a number of initiatives regarding CSOs and tech engagement in the Asia Pacific region together with Article 19. So my background is quite messy, I would say, because I worked in the corporate world, I worked in the multilateral world with the diplomats, and I worked, of course, with the businesses and with the nonprofit in the area of cybersecurity, human rights, and human rights impact assessment of technological countries, and also in a way of, let's say, finding the common ground between civil society, private sector, and governments. And you may hear my voice, sometimes annoying voice, talking about sad things at the big forums like RightsCon, Internet Governance Forum, and et cetera. So happy to be here and happy to discuss with you our upcoming translated report on Asia region, where we're going to talk about human rights implications provided by tech sector.
And we're very happy to have your insights and your knowledge. So before we talk about the report itself, let's talk about Article 19, because it sounds quite ominous, almost, Article 19. Can you tell us what Article 19 actually is and what it is that you predominantly do?
Well, Article 19 actually is quite old nonprofit organization. So, yes, if we're looking back how many years we're existing, it's positive. So we survived. But anyway, we're almost 40. Years old. In general, let's say the general explanation of Article 19, we are the international human rights organization, of course, that defends and promotes the freedom of expression and access to information worldwide. We have teams around the globe. We are named after Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the organization believes that everyone has the right to speak freely, to access information, and to hold those in power to account. Working at the intersection of law, policy, technology, we try to empower communities and support journalists and activists. And of course, challenge the laws which are not compliant with international human rights principles. And we promote practices that practices which are helping to introduce international human rights standards in the policies, legislation, and practices. And as I already mentioned, we have regional offices and teams working on earlier mentioned topics and directions, and of course, with the main office in the UK.
Mm. Okay, so that's quite a broad and powerful remit. So I think that gives us a good idea. So let's look more specifically at what we're dealing with today. So the article that we've got here is Human Rights Responsibilities and Challenges for Tech Companies Operating in Authoritarian Countries. And we'll try to link a copy of this below the podcast for anyone who's interested in reading it themselves. And this was released in September of 2024. So can you give us a brief overview of what the main focus of this report is and what the main purpose of the report is?
Yeah. Well, the report became public last year, since it was just published just before the UN Business and Human Rights Forum in Bangkok, where we actually had a very good respond on the findings and that showed us the necessity of these topics, especially on UN business and human rights principles and tech sector in that case. Well, about the report. So report is covering several countries in the region, namely China, Vietnam, and Myanmar, and tech sector activities and operations in those countries. So it explores how tech companies grapple with their human rights responsibilities, especially freedom of expression and privacy, and how they, mingle that in the authoritarian regimes. So we cover China, Vietnam, and Myanmar there, and some cases from the private sector and the responses of the private sector in that regards. And of course, the actions of the government towards oppression of freedom of expression, content moderation in general, and their introduced laws.
Mm. And so this I think is a good place for us to start talking about the technical realities, because we understand, those of us who have been following Myanmar, but also anyone who has experience with any authoritarian regime, we understand that governments pass laws to try to limit the freedom of expression, as you say, to illegalize the creation of certain types of content, the on-sharing of certain types of content, in some cases, even the possession of certain types of content. But what I think a lot of people don't think about is that when these laws are written, it is private companies in the majority of cases who have to understand those laws, interpret those laws, and they have to enforce those laws within themselves. So looking as just as a starting point in the Myanmar context, when the military regime decides to censor certain types of content, to what extent is the military themselves going after this content, trying to remove it from the internet, trying to arrest people who share this content or create this content? And to what extent are they simply passing laws that require private companies to do this work on their behalf?
Well, yeah, it's a very, very complicated question, I would say, because taking consideration that since February 2021, the current leadership or junta or SEC, it has different names in different publics, acting, it's obviously that oppression is happening not only in the physical world, also in the digital world. And the laws which were introduced, or amended laws which were introduced in the countries, like amended electronic transaction law or anti-terrorist law, are actually really pushing tech sector, or let's say ICT sector, it includes telecoms, to be compliant with the requirements. And since we have less and less let's say foreign companies in the country, basically only Sumitomo KDDI from the telecom side partially operating as a foreign company in Myanmar is trying to, I don't know how to call it, but is trying to float somehow in the area. But otherwise, all other ICT and tech companies are fully compliant with oppressive laws. And the recently announced law on cybersecurity law, which, as many of my colleagues who work on Myanmar know, that this law been awaited since 2017, and a lot of work has been done even before the coup to promote the human rights, let's say, centric articles to that law. But still, it's oppressive, and it provides a lot of limits to the freedom of expression, to access to information, and moreover, it doesn't really provide any clear guidance within the law. Although we know that, for instance, with the cybersecurity law in Myanmar of this year, the law was released. However, the more descriptive or detailed explanation or guidance on how to comply with those articles on VPN blogs, for instance, are not public yet. However, maybe telecoms already know how to navigate in that case, but this is not public. And unfortunately, we don't have clear information in this case how to measure that oppression. But it's obviously that internet shutdowns, and especially the ones after the devastated earthquake in March, affected that. It's not even content moderation issue anymore. It's just the access to internet, because electricity and is shutting down more often due to the conflict zones and due to the earthquake, infrastructure being destroyed as well. So the net is overloaded, and it's basically like you don't even need to have a group of people moderating the content when there's like no even access to content. I'm talking too broad here, but like feel free if you need any more guided questions in this case.
Well, because this is what I'm wondering, particularly when it comes to the telecommunications, as you mentioned it, it's very difficult for us to know what's happening within these companies and these organizations. And the example that comes to my mind that I've spoken about in the past is that of Telenor, who were told by the military that they would be forced to effectively hand over the data of their many users in Myanmar to the military. And because phone calls are not encrypted, SMSs are not encrypted, this is an enormous risk. And Telenor chose to leave Myanmar, saying that they could not ethically remain in the country. And the question that I think has still not been answered is exactly how much information was Telenor willing to give over to the military when they exited the country and allowed their infrastructure to be purchased by Mitel, and how much of that information would Telenor have been able to protect or encrypt or in some way, shape or form prevent the military from getting access to. In cases like these, where we're talking about telecommunications companies that are handling literally millions of people's personal communications, is there any way for us to know what these companies are doing to comply with the government, what these companies are doing to try to protect their users' rights to freedom of expression, rights to freedom of information? Do we have any insight into this at all, or is it just a black box?
Well, first of all, we have to start from the legislation side. As you might be aware, that the laws, even before the coup, were not really tailored to be human rights-centric and not really had enough of safeguards, let's say, for the one who could be affected in terms of, let's say, content moderation, data sharing, etc. And there is still no privacy and data protection law in Myanmar, which could somehow, let's say, protect the right holders. Even famous cybersecurity law, which once had some recommendations on and articles included privacy and data protection, but then it was criticized even after the coup, and the business community actually pushed a lot on removing privacy and data protection parts from that. In, I think, if I'm not wrong, in 2021 version of cybersecurity law, to remove it. And those articles appeared in the amended electronic transaction law. So this is one thing. Another thing in terms of private sector actions, in terms of requirements or orders, which are unlawful, obviously, because the current leadership is not legal government, and you can ask any, let's say, more or less educated Myanmar person about, like, who is actually should be considered a government. I mean, there were elections in 2020 and NLD won those elections. However, the current SAC is not admitting that, but unfortunately, all the new legislation are basically unconstitutional and basically not reflecting the legality. However, when you have a, let's say, business which feeds thousands of people, it's always difficult to navigate in the current situation in Myanmar, because one side you have people who are depend on the salaries, and the economic situation in Myanmar is getting worse and worse. And the other side, you have to comply with the human rights requirements. It's difficult and not easy. However, in, let's say, in Telenor case, Telenor Myanmar case, well, in comparison with other telecoms in the country, let's say before the coup, Telenor was the most responsive and the most engaged, the most engagement open company in that time. Even during the exit, it was criticized by a group of civil society activists that it was not really cooperative in terms of their decisions regarding the exit. But I must say, yes, they could have done more work in terms of discussing the steps of the exit with the civil society before they decided that, and especially which company they wanted to sell this Telenor Myanmar. However, the civil society was put in front of the fact that they decided to exit. And the sale to M Group, M1 Group, sorry, of course, came as the surprise. And then resale to Shui Pian Piu. It's a military-affiliated company, which still considers itself that they are not affiliated and not, let's say, responsible to the SEC actions, still raised a lot of questions.
One thing that came up in the report, like one thing that you mentioned is that, or the report mentions, is that there are a number of companies that simply did not recognize the military as a legitimate government, which, I mean, makes sense. Obviously, the NLD won the election, and there's no legitimacy behind the military coup. But if a company simply says, we do not recognize the military as a legitimate government, and we therefore do not recognize the instructions and legislation that the military provides as legitimate, what sort of risks and dangers would that company be facing?
Well, so far the companies which are located in Myanmar, and there are only few, so far to our knowledge, we haven't seen any which said that they don't, let's say, they don't recognize the SEC as a government and they're still there. So those companies which are based in Myanmar don't do this publicly. Perhaps there might be some CEOs which are not agreeing with SEC and don't recognize them. But so far, there was nothing like that. I think Telenor is also, I mean, the exit of Telenor in Myanmar was not really directly related to the SEC as a government recognition. It was more to the sanctions which were imposed to certain services providers which Telenor Myanmar wanted to purchase. And they apparently those risks were higher than just to conduct the services in Myanmar and recognize the SEC as the government. Plus, surveillance requirements imposed by the state to the telecoms, which also required to use a certain surveillance technologies, which could be a sanction case, like from the certain countries, including China and et cetera. So that could put a big, let's say, shadow on the reputation of Telenor as a company, not only in Myanmar, but like globally.
So coming back to this, the article, your article is mostly talking about companies that are not based within Myanmar. So the big example that comes up here is talking about Facebook, saying that Facebook has, and I'm quoting, indefinitely suspended the ability for Myanmar government agencies to send content removal requests to Facebook through our normal channels reserved for authorities around the world. That's a pretty sizable step. I don't know whether that's still in place, whether that's still Facebook policy, but in response to something like this, if I don't think Facebook has any offices within Myanmar, but would Facebook as a company be facing the possibility of simply being blocked nationwide?
Well, yeah, I mean, the second part of your question about companies recognizing the SEC, well, Meta didn't have official office in Myanmar. They had the, let's say, office which was conducting financial transactions. For instance, when you had ads to buy from the Facebook platform, so you had to pay for this forever, right? So, but otherwise, like in a, let's say in a general way, Meta was not located in Myanmar. So for the company which is operating in Myanmar and not located in Myanmar, it's a different case, same as for Google, for instance. Yeah, they've been quite vocal in terms of the SEC actions and SEC activities even before coup, when a number of pro-military profiles appeared on the Facebook platform, and they were blocked. And even during elections, a number of profiles been blocked by Meta. After the coup, Meta, of course, didn't recognize the SEC's state, and plus Meta, specifically Facebook, was used as a platform for democracy activists to mobilize and, of course, to criticize junta. So for this reason, for these reasons, I would say, SEC blocked Meta's products in the country, including Instagram, WhatsApp, and Facebook. However, at the same time, they were conducting press conferences on Facebook to convey the message of of SEC's 5 points strategy on achieving the disciplined democracy and peace and respect of human rights in the country. So Google is not blocked so far, but I think it's a bit different case. Relatively recently, since July, end of June, July last year, Signal got blocked by SEC. However, Signal was responsive in terms of providing separate solutions to the users of Myanmar to bypass those blocks. So, it goes through some, it's like a subject of a digital security, would say, or literacy, that there are some settings in this, in Signal, which allows you to access that. And Meta is still blocked in the country, Meta's product. Of course, there's no staff located in the country. However, the content moderation is still happening, and especially pro-military propaganda content is taken down. I would not say that it's successfully taken down and fast, but Meta's stand regarding the content moderation in Myanmar is still the same, despite of the new policies announced by Mark Zuckerberg lately regarding the content moderation in the U.S. Interesting to see that after the military coup in Myanmar, a lot of users shifted to Telegram, which, as you may know, that it was founded by Russian citizen Mr. Durov, and that platform became actually very, very problematic in terms of the content moderation and threats to pro-democracy activists and voices regarding the atrocities conducted by the military junta.
I mean, I am familiar with Durov and his many legal troubles as well. A lot of governments are very angry at Telegram and also Signal exploding in the Myanmar context. But this is this topic of moderation, I think, is something that needs to be discussed, because we can look at Telegram as an example of a Wild West, a place where there is, at least officially, basically no moderation at all. And this has naturally allowed Telegram to become a home for many different types of criminals. And of course, many in the Myanmar military use Telegram, and there are pro-military Telegram channels. But at the same time, when we look at Facebook, Facebook announcing moderation now in Myanmar and the deplatforming of military channels and YouTube deplatforming military channels, it seems to be in stark contrast with the policies and the attitudes that Facebook had in 2016, 2017, 2018 with regards to the racial hatred content, the promulgation of genocide that Facebook had a part in, unwittingly, but it had a part in Myanmar, just as it similarly had an impact in Sri Lanka. The moderation standards from these companies seem to be very erratic, Speaking cynically, I would say they almost seem to be based more on public opinion in Western countries and public pressure in Western countries than they are on actual objective good. So my core question is, do these companies, do they seem to have an actual core set of ethics that allows them to determine what does and does not need to be moderated? And do they actually stick to that core set of ethics? Because looking from the outside, to me, it appears that they're always scrambling to make a response to a situation when it's already too late.
Well, normally, yeah, I mean, these companies have their community standards. For instance, Meta always citing community standards as a Bible at some point, yeah. And references that, let's say, if it's a harmful content, political content, let's say religion and etc., they do have that. But we also have to look at the side of, let's say, content moderation itself. So since 2017, why Facebook became so famous, I mean, a part of the Rakhine crisis, right? And speeding up the hateful speech on their platforms and algorithms which were helping with that. We also have to look at the workforce of those content moderators. Well, at that time, since that time, actually, so far to our knowledge, we know that the content moderation groups on Myanmar languages, like Myanmar has more than 135, if I'm not wrong, ethnicities which have their languages. It's not only Bamazagha, like Myanmar language. It's also other languages which are used to publish content. So we need to understand that it's not an easy case. It's not like, let's say, Mandarin, where you have number of people knowing the language and be able to understand what is written on platforms, or even to, let's say, verify the content, the complex and, let's say, cultural meanings and context behind the certain posts or videos and pictures. We're talking about very small and very tiny group of people knowing, let's say, Rakhine language and being able to identify those specifics, hateful speech or, let's say, or fake news on the platforms. And even Myanmar language like Bamazagha also is quite complex. So there's not enough workforce which could verify those contents. And unfortunately, as you may know, Oversight Board, which I think, to my knowledge, only once had a case about Myanmar when it was related to the term Chinese, which one of the prominent Facebook user posted that accused actually Chinese being part of the coup. And this post was taken down and that user actually forwarded that request to appeal the takedown through the Oversight Board. It's like a side institution formed by Meta to decide on different cases. So taking that, it means that, I mean, to our knowledge, is that there's not that many understand that certain posts could be actually bring back through Oversight Board, or like they're not just simply reported, or people just don't know that there is a possibility to do so. On TikTok, for instance, TikTok was criticized a lot after the coup, that it'd been following the same path as Meta since 2000s. Like basically TikTok did the same faults as Meta did in 2017, but TikTok repeated that in 2021 when it was promoting military's videos with a hateful speech and showing off their guns and telling that, let's say, they would shoot the protesters with those guns and fine their families, or even shaming. And then this, I mean, TikTok also has the community standards regarding what, like, what kind of content should be on the platform and which one should be taken down. But unfortunately, it's not that responsive as, let's say, Western companies in their approach to content moderation.
Yes. And so I just, this might be outside of your scope, but I'd be very curious to hear your thoughts on this. When we look at platforms like Meta and contrast them with Telegram, because I take your point. I do take your point, and it is very difficult to get someone in the United States to moderate content being written in, say, Shan or Karen or something like this. However, I also happen to know that Facebook was directly contacted by people who were able and willing to do the translation work, saying that we have identified harmful content, and Facebook did not respond to them. So recognizing that the content moderation rules of companies like Meta can be a little bit variable and vague, in your opinion, would you say it is better to have a system that is unmoderated, but at least it is equal and reliable across the board, or a system that does have moderation, but that is going to have problems where it over-moderates in situations when that is not necessary and under-moderates in situations when it really should have acted faster? What do you think is the better option?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is really, I think if I would have the best answer, I would be really popular person in this case, but... I'm familiar with, let's say, context of Slavic nature, and I could understand some of the thoughts of Durov behind his platform. But at the same time, I'm a person who is human rights activist and human rights defender, and I think over moderation, it's direct violation of freedom of expression. So, the quality of freedom of expression and, let's say, fake news are not freedom of expression. Misinformation is not freedom of expression. And that's actually making us, our life in general as, let's say, digital services users is quite complicated. Well, first of all, platform has to have principles which are compliant with international human rights standards, meaning that it should be right for information, right for access, right for freedom of expression. Of course, if they put the fake news and misinformation or propaganda of, let's say, atrocities and authoritarian regimes, this should not be acceptable because that directly affects the freedoms of people, of their choice and their human rights in general. The same time, platform which doesn't regulate anything, it creates a lot of security issues for the users. Because, for instance, on Telegram, as you also may know, that's like the cases of doxing of Myanmar, human rights defenders, even Chinese human rights defenders and Vietnamese human rights defenders is like quite high. And this is not really about freedoms. This is about physical security of people and their lives. Saying that Telegram is not moderated, it's actually not fully true. Because when the war started with Russia and Ukraine, Telegram moderated some of the content on their platforms. I think it's a matter of interest of the owner of the platform here. I mean, we're talking about that. It's not about that they don't moderate at all. Yes, and also some security features on the platform, even for simple end users, is quite questionable on Telegram. I honestly don't know how a small group of people of a huge platform can manage the safety, security of the entire infrastructure and ecosystem of this platform. This is, I don't know, maybe Mr. Durov is a genius who will be very known, and we study him in the books in 10 years, how to do this? Or maybe it's just the marketing in terms of that platform is not moderated, and they don't have a moderators who would really do the job, for instance, as even TikTok or even Meta's products at the way. So yeah, sorry, it's a difficult question to say, like, but the most important is that we have to have the right for information and to express ourselves on the platform.
Because where I'm sort of going with this is that governments clearly, this is obviously in the report, governments cannot be trusted because some governments are going to be authoritarian and dictatorial, and they are going to legislate against the right to freedom of expression. However, the companies themselves also are highly variable. We can say whatever we want to say about Facebook, we can say whatever we want to say about Telegram, but they are very different in how they approach these things. Is there, whether from Article 19 or from anyone else, is there an attempt to develop a standard, a protocol or a system or a code that is apolitical, that is international, that private sector companies are being invited to incorporate or to base their own internal content moderation and content protection policies on?
Well, there is a number of recommendations coming from a variety of groups of how the content should be moderated or which steps to take. I mean, from the perspective of, let's say, our initiative on engaging civil society in tech sector, what we're recommending is like the usual part. I mean, the usual part in our side, in our work. Well, we recommend, of course, to uphold the human rights standards and according to UN business and human rights principles that's for like companies. It's not only content moderation. It's a full scale for the company to comply with. Of course, to conduct human rights due diligence and human rights impact assessment exercise, because let's say before introducing certain services or operations in the platforms, it's better to understand how that will impact the human rights in general. And if, let's say, it's done afterwards, there are still cases, including Facebook, Microsoft, or Alphabet, Google, or even Viber, Rakuten. There are certain cases which created certain human rights violations. We need to do a sort of human rights impact assessment of those violations and provide the remedies provided by consultations with the civil society, experts, and tech sector. Of course, we want private sector to be more transparent and to be more responsive when things are flagged by civil society and solve those issues together without, you know, without a scare of being, let's say, given to the authoritarian countries and saying like, oh, this is the human rights defender and he was criticizing certain activities, so just get rid of them. No, we want to build those trust relationship, and if tech sector wants civil society to be responsive and cooperative, they also have to provide a certain security insurance at some point. There are lots of things mentioned in the Santa Clara principles regarding, let's say, those cooperations between civil society and private sector and, of course, the government. Because in some countries, let's say, if we minus Myanmar here, because we don't call for cooperation with the current leadership in Myanmar, but there are still countries like Vietnam and China, which still, I mean, it's difficult, but we still hope that some of the legislation can be helped and it will also affect the operations of the tech sector in those countries, and including their contents. I mean, you already mentioned policies, of course, in terms of like what, how to make them. I mean, those policies should be usually based on country contexts. We cannot have one global policy like it was in 2017 with Facebook, like global policy for everyone. It's impossible. Countries have their different traditions, cultural context, understanding, level of reaction to certain activities or actions.
Not at all. And I want to look into what it is that the companies can do, because as you're talking, I'm getting ideas and I'm getting thoughts, and the first sort of question that I have, because I just want to clarify how this actually theoretically works, is laws and jurisdictions, because if we're talking about a conventional type of company that, I don't know, sells bread or something like this, then if I go to that company in Germany, then I physically go into a building that is in Germany, staffed by citizens who are German citizens, and the laws of Germany apply to that one. And if I cross the border into Poland, then I'm in a company that is now registered in Poland, the staff are Polish, the building is in Poland, and so on and so on and so forth. With these tech companies, though, they are typically registered in a country. Meta is based in the United States. And if they don't have offices in Myanmar, they don't physically have staff in Myanmar, they don't have anything like this in Myanmar, I'm wondering, does this mean that Facebook's moderation in Myanmar, would that be subject to US laws? Is it possible for a couple of Western countries to simply compel tech companies to adopt certain policies internationally? Or how does that work? Is there possibility for this type of resolution to this problem? Just get a few countries that are the governments of the countries where the tech companies are registered, and use them to force the tech companies to roll out a global moderation policy? Or would the companies always be able to say, no, you cannot tell me how I do and do not operate outside of your borders?
Well, I mean, in case of Europe, as you know, the countries which are part of the European Union, they have laws within the countries, and the general law, let's say the European Commission law or created law, which regulates those data flows, like GDPR, for instance, general data protection, and etc. But let's say if certain case specifically related to safety and security of Poland, and you, let's say, you are not Polish citizen, but you are still covered by EU law, so that's another process. In terms of US companies and like Meta, Microsoft, Google, and etc., even Amazon, operating in the countries where are not physically located. Well, I think if we take Myanmar in this case, Meta's activities and content moderation are more of a, let's say, goodwill action, although quite well criticized by civil society in terms of that they don't do enough. And I agree in this case, because they could have provided more efforts and capacity in terms of content moderation, at least to remove the harmful content which put people into physical threats, and provide more policies for securing their profiles, location, identities, and etc. These are not regulated by laws. I mean, this is not what the law tells you. Like, you cannot, let's say, introduce policy to protect your profile or to lock your profile, correct? So
yeah,
they could introduce that, and they did after the coup in Myanmar. In certain cases, of course, U.S. companies are taking the U.S. law as the main law to focus on and comply with. and especially when it comes to sanctions or national security cases. But let's say if Junta writes a letter, because I mean they cannot meet Meta right now, so like writes Meta letter and saying like I want all the data of this and these people, of course Meta has the full right not even to react on their actions. Unfortunately, we don't know all the third-party service providers of Meta in the countries because Meta is a huge company and they have different products, not only Instagram, Facebook, and WhatsApp. But for instance, if let's say if it's a data center which Meta use in Myanmar to store some of their data, then that will be a subject of response based on Myanmar law, to my knowledge. I mean, I'm not representing any organization decision here. It's just strictly my opinion about the case.
Naturally.
Same to other countries. I mean, if they don't have a local representative or local official third-party service provider in the country, they have full right not to respond to the orders and requests of a certain state. Another thing with the platforms is that it's the data collection action. As you know, a lot of digital services and platforms like to collect as much possible data as possible, as it possible. And the countries like, let's say, Myanmar, Laos, even Cambodia, which have huge gaps in the legislation regarding data protection and data collection, certain companies are taking advantage of. So they like suck this data as much as possible because that means money, that means additional requests for ads and etc. And recommendation here is that, I mean, not to violate any law is that you don't really need to collect unnecessary data. You need to collect data which is necessary within, let's say, the law. Companies doesn't really need to collect unnecessary data. And that doesn't mean that they would violate the law if it's not strictly written in the law that, let's say, you have to collect age, birth, and location of a certain user. This is the easiest way to be more, let's say, pro-human rights centric platform when you don't put into a physical threat of a human rights defender just because you have enough data which gives the platform to allows to operate and not really overseeding the operations in the certain countries, especially in the conflict zones where everyone is under threat.
So I'm wondering about this because you've throughout this, I just want to clarify the legal position here, because throughout the interview and throughout the report as well, it's very clear that Article 19 feels that companies have a responsibility to step up and to take action and to protect people and to protect civil liberties. And I'm wondering whether there is, in fact, any law, any international law that does this, the International Declaration of Human Rights, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I don't think would apply to a private company. Is there any legal requirement placed on companies, whether through domestic law or international law, is there any legal instrument through which companies do have a legal responsibility to protect the civil liberties of their users?
I don't really want to comment on the legal international legal obligations of certain countries because I'm not really feeling comfortable talking about that. I mean, in regarding the, let's say, war times, so like war, there are certain legal obligations of state and private sector to comply with. But in case of companies which consider themselves responsible or human rights friendly, human rights centric. So far, I'm not aware of those laws. But again, there is still a gap to fill in. But there are countries which are governments which are signed up under the UN Business Human Rights Principles, and they're committed that their private sector will comply with those principles. Like, for instance, Norway was one of them, which followed that policy to the private sector. And this is why actually Telenor was very engagement open company in Myanmar, because they had that policy in the DNA of the company. Like many other European companies, like, for instance, Ericsson, they also have that. And they had specific staff who was in charge of human rights issues or human rights due diligence exercise within the country. I mean, they still have in different other countries. But legally so far, I don't think that, let's say, we could have really sue some of the companies for sharing data with oppressive regimes. There is a case with Telenor Myanmar on personal data, but it's handled in Norway. We still don't know what's the outcome. Mm-hmm. However, it seems that some certain data was shared, was not... They really, I mean, it's so far it's that there was not proper, let's say, safety guards taking to protect personal data of that user. And somehow the user is related to Myanmar. So it's very, very weak case.
Yes. But I want to turn to the report here, because it's very interesting that you are mentioning this. Telenor went in because of these principles, but Telenor also left because of these principles. And the report is basically saying that, and I'm going to quote here, tech companies should not rely on general references to the importance of staying in a particular market to explain compliance with government demands, as Facebook has sometimes done in Vietnam. So this now opens up this other question. Telenor left. And I know a lot of people who have been quite critical of this, saying that, well, leaving was not benefiting the people of Myanmar. Telenor leaving the country is not advantageous to them. It protects Telenor's moral integrity, but it doesn't protect the people. But simultaneously, we have the opposite side, companies that say, well, I don't want to leave this country, even though I'm being forced to comply with oppressive laws, because I believe I provide a service. And in cases like Myanmar, in cases like Sri Lanka and other countries like this, Facebook has definitely made this argument where they say, well, the market depends on us. Economy depends on us. People do trade on Facebook. They find jobs on Facebook. They sell things on Facebook. Is there, in your opinion, a strong enough argument here? Is it possible for a company to be complying with these oppressive systems but still be bringing a net benefit to the people of a country by providing them an opportunity to find employment or to do trade?
Let's imagine you are building an application, mm-hmm. and you have, let's say, business. Well, you're building an application for a hairdresser salon. Okay, and you decide what kind of data you want to collect. So meaning that what you want, if you want to build a client database, you will collect the phone number of your client, perhaps the date of the appointment, correct?
Yes.
And, okay, you can collect, for instance, birthday of your client.
Yeah.
But you don't need to collect the person's medical requirements, family state, or address. So you can decide, right? And that's actually in many laws so far, this is not like a requirement that's simple, say business has to collect a lot of data.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you're not violating a law. Same applies to the companies as well. So they have a very, most of them, they have capacity to have strong legal support in analyzing the laws and the gaps with the laws in terms of where can we, let's say, comply with the law, but at the same time provide the safeguards to the users and make sure that their physical and, let's say, the physical security is not violated, their rights are not violated. I think it's, I mean, it's possible from the perspective of making those services and platforms human rights friendly. There's just no strong will to do so because it requires additional staff, it requires additional effort, and it requires to listen to the criticism of the human rights defenders and activists about the operations. Yeah, one thing when you have a certain, let's say, ICT infrastructure, antennas, for instance, it's another thing. So, for instance, you cannot make antenna to give you water, right? So one thing is like when you are requesting certain like impossible things, it's another part, but with the digital things and software, it's always done by a human. The code is done by a human. So, and due to our work with a number of countries, including China, including Vietnam and Myanmar, we see that certain cases are possible to fix, and they're possible to fix even just changing algorithm. For example, one of the research on Myanmar over the Rakhine state was on this like buttons, you know, like, and it was proven that certain emotion promotes certain content more strongly. Like when you, for instance, when you put positive like, it promotes faster among the communities and users of the platform rather than opposite. And certain those who know how to manipulate the content and like the spread of content, they abuse those algorithms. But those can be fixed because this is the set of algorithm which can be fixed by a human. So
yes.
Of course, we cannot change it 100%. This is impossible. But we can make it more safer. And we can do the efforts, and tech companies can do that for sure. They have resources, and those resources are coming from us, from our users. They don't put those resources just from their own pockets.
Of course. And so the thing that stood out to me here, it's not just what you're talking about here is the capability for these companies, obviously, to improve themselves and therefore to improve our lives as the users. And you're saying that the capability is there, the possibility is there, but what is missing is the willpower. And what's interesting is that in the report, it does say that there have been, I'm just going to quote again, tech companies have had some success when presenting organized opposition to data localization requirements. Industry voices seem to have had an impact on the military in Myanmar, withdrawing the draft cybersecurity law and on the easing of a data localization requirement in a proposed Vietnamese regulation. So it does seem that under certain circumstances, these companies are not only willing to advocate for, even if not change, but a preservation of the status quo in the face of government regulation, but they are apparently also capable of mounting enough of an organized and unified front against these governments, against these regimes, that sometimes these governments and regimes will back down and will not push forward with their legislation. And I'm wondering, A, how are these tech companies able to push back against you know, oppressive regimes? And B, if they're able to do it in these cases, why is there no willpower in the industry to do it elsewhere?
Well, I guess we always have to ask them in terms of why they are not interested to do that. Well, I guess the first thing is we always have to consider that it's a private sector, it's a business. It's always goes first about the profit and then about other policies. And when, let's say, when a certain case raised by civil society, like, let's say, the Rohingya case with the spread of hate speech, or let's say some pro-Tibetan activists on some Chinese platforms, or Vietnam issues regarding, let's say, ecology activist detention. When those cases are amplified and known, so it becomes a threat to the users, to other users of those platforms, which kind of, it's more of a reputational risks. And then companies start thinking that those risks might affect their profits, the users, which might, you know, leave the platform or might not use the platform for certain activities, which they used to do so. Or investors might not be interested in the company which is not compliant with the human rights or not ethical in terms of the human rights compliance. So when that becomes a case, they start acting. When there's no voices, there's no raising of the certain issues, like issues regarding the content moderation, access to information on those platforms, or overall, even in some cases, even the founders of the platforms, companies are not really willing to do anything. Another thing is the legislation. Unfortunately, in authoritarian countries, civil society spaces are very shrinked, and they have very limited access to consultations on the upcoming laws and provision of, let's say, human rights centric policies. And in this case, sometimes businesses are taking very important part to advocate for international standards on human rights compliance and adding those points into the laws, but they are not interested due to the threats of being kicked out from the country or license being taken from them or just being blocked. I mean, in Myanmar, it's a bit different case because lots of foreign companies entered the countries during the democratic times. But let's say in Vietnam, it's another very interesting market where companies want to stay. And with the, let's say, current situation with the US and China, companies are interested in the market, but they, like, it's really hard to see them advocating for democratic laws right now, and especially recommending China to, let's say, to be pro freedom of expression and not to target the human rights activists and etc. So yeah, it's a complicated question, but I don't think that we should stop and not doing anything as a civil society. There should be still raising voices, and especially from the Asia region, and we need more people to understand the importance of a private sector, especially tech sector, in the life of human rights and in our life in general, because we are the users of those services and we want to have services which are safe for us, not only through the digital security side, but also from the our freedoms side.
Mm. Absolutely. And I think that that's kind of the big theme, is it, that all of the questions are complicated. All of these issues are very complicated, but we can't use complicated as an excuse to not take action at all. And I know that the report is sort of frequently comes back to the point of civil society cooperation. I know that you've mentioned civil society as a vital element of this. What I'm wondering is, what is the exact role that you envisage for civil society? How would a partnership between private sector and civil society work? Would there be a direct line of communication? Would civil societies be the ones responsible for identifying content on behalf of the companies and then flagging that content for the companies to moderate? Or would civil societies purely take a role in drafting the, I don't know, the processes or drafting the moderation guidelines for these companies and then letting them enforce them on their own? How do you think it is best for companies to cooperate with civil society on this issue?
Well, I mean, each country has its own specific approach, because as I mentioned earlier, for instance, we cannot use global policies for every country in this case. Well, the cooperation with the civil society and private sector, tech sector specifically, is already happening. There are plenty of, there are many, but not many groups which are working on digital rights issues. And for instance, a huge number of communities are coming at the RightsCon where they cooperate and they discuss and provide some recommendations to tech sector directly on the RightsCon on, let's say, what to do with the certain content moderation or their policies regarding the data storage or the policies regarding the freedom of expression compliance and etc. Well, I think, first of all, we have to there should be, let's say, country-dedicated groups which would flag country-specific issues. And they have to, their capacity should be increased. Because so far to our work with, let's say, engaging with tech sector, we see certain countries, especially Asia, is lacking those groups which would be experts in the digital rights. There are people, there are stars which are very knowledgeable and they always in cooperation with the tech sector and provide them with their recommendations on the legislation, on the compliance, on the policies, and even issues which appear during, let's say, operation of the platform. But we need more civil society actors who would understand what means let's say digital rights and like the right to access information, right to freedom of expression in digital space and privacy. And when they understand that, they can go to a different level of, let's say, human rights due diligence involvement with agencies like Article 1 or BSR, which are doing the human rights impact assessment for telcos and tech sector. And they can also convey messages from their communities and saying, like, for instance, or like, we have telecom in our village, but it doesn't work. There is no internet or there is no simple telecom service. It's also, I mean, part of the topic. Even this part of, I mean, this piece of information is useful and helps to build more capacity for those CSOs and knowledge and like build overall understanding on human rights due diligence. And then let's say the third level of this engagement is that when you have a community which has the knowledge on digital rights and internet freedoms or even just the basic human rights in terms of freedom of expression, privacy, data protection, so they can cooperate with the groups like Freedom of Online Coalition. It's the coalition based on states which are pro-human rights and they push tech sector and telecoms to be human rights compliant and comply with the business and human rights principles and comply with the requirements to that let's say, community have access to information, access to internet, and access to a variety of legislation, which is like human rights friendly. Then there is Global Network Initiative, which is a group of business and civil society and academia, which works 24/7 on providing really good recommendations and policies, sometimes criticism and assessment of and for tech sector based on the voices from the community and civil society. And then we have a lot of forums where people can represent their ideas and, of course, recommendations on how to make this digital space more friendly to international business and human rights friendly, human rights standards. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, I can sound like a marketing specialist. I can also promote a couple of tools which we issued. And they also can use those, like on human rights impact assessment and et cetera.
I'm sure there are many, many different tools, but I think we just need to get the ball rolling. We just need to start, I think, normalizing having that kind of relationship with civil society, because as it stands, from my understanding of the last 10 years, large tech companies, whether it's usually it's Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, these are the three big ones that keep coming up in these case studies. But these tech companies have historically not only not been reaching out to civil society organizations, but have actively been ignoring civil society organizations when those organizations have proactively reached out and said, there is a problem, there is a crisis happening that you are contributing to, and you are not willing to take action and you are not willing to change what you're doing, even if it's going to cost lives. So I think just the normalization of listening to civil society organizations, listening to locally engaged organizations, and you know, changing your practices to suit the needs of a community and the particulars of a community, and to recognize the harm that you might be doing to a community is, I think, just the first step that has to be taken before we can even get into all the complexities of all the different tools and the ways and the potential that exists here. On which point, I think, as a final question, I'm just curious, in your work, how receptive have you found, or have you heard, tech companies being to these types of recommendations? I mean, the report makes plenty of recommendations, and they're very reasonable and sensible recommendations for what companies can be doing or should be doing. But have you seen generally companies paying attention to this and reaching out or trying to proactively implement these policies and these recommendations? Or is the private sector generally ignoring the recommendations and just trying to avoid government scrutiny and do business as best as they can?
Well, each country is different. I mean, to say that they don't engage and don't listen, it's not really true to my mind, because we do have meetings and we do have engagement with the private sector, including Meta, including Alphabet, and some other platforms, even Microsoft, even TikTok, actually. We do have those discussions. The question here is that, well, not the question, the problem here is that that some communities, they see a problem, but they don't know how to form it in the way that it's a problem, and there is no solution provided by the within the description of the problem. So in most of the times, it's just a criticism. Of course, I'm not talking about my digital rights colleagues who are knowledgeable in this sphere. They already know the drill and they know how to convey the message and provide the solution and make the ball rolling. But there are some communities which don't really know how to do that. And within Article 19, we have initiative Engaging Tech for Internet Freedom, which helps those CSOs to understand. So first of all, if they have a problem, they have tools which helps them to form the problem in, let's say, in a short report or short policy paper, which they can use to engage with tech sector. And it's like more of a business-friendly language there, which business can understand, and then based on that, engage with them. And we also provide a number of recommendations how to run the, let's say, how to form a strategy of that engagement with the tech sector. So making them to pay attention and respond. In terms of fixing all those problems, that's the thing. Even stars of digital rights community having this issue that not everything, every issue happening in the platforms is solved. Well, of course, there's a number of reasons for that. Sometimes there is no will, sometimes there is no, the message was not conveyed correctly. And there are also cases with the legislation, especially, let's say, in the markets like Vietnam or China, when, let's say, compliance with a certain case, like compliance by tech sector in a certain case cost them business in the country. So, yeah. But there are cases where private sector been responsive. For instance, in Sri Lanka, private sector is quite active in terms of engaging with the civil society and state on forming a number of ICT legislations. Even there's like very high interest in the AI policies in Sri Lanka. On Vietnam, there were some activities from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce regarding the data protection legislation. Of course, the last decision was by the government of Vietnam, but the efforts of the tech sector were noticeable in terms of trying to influence certain laws. And especially on data localization part, because Vietnam legislation on data localization was quite severe and quite detailed, which sometimes is not necessary for the law. I mean, from the practical reasons. Yeah, well, there are some, I'm sure, I mean, some positive sides of that engagement too. And I think that's better than absolute non-engagement in our sector, because as you know, like if there is no engagement, so there is no problem, but there is no recorded problem. So when nobody pays attention until it blasts. So yeah, that's it for me.
I mean, fair enough. There's all of these questions. I know they're very open-ended and they just sort of invite a very detailed and very long response. But that said, I think we've covered a lot of ground. I think we've managed to give people a much clearer idea of the situation that is facing companies who are trying to operate in these very difficult and I think we can say very hostile governments, and the moral and ethical and legal position that they find themselves in.
I have a message to my colleagues and those who are listening, and especially those who work in the side of policy forming and human rights side, because sometimes people feel really upset that lots of atrocities and oppressive behavior from authoritarian regimes are happening. And I've been witnessed a lot of colleagues who gave up on their ideas and ideology in terms of protection of human rights, just because they see that it's never changing and the world is not becoming better. I think that's their personal view. And in our space, these things are not changing in one day. We should look back to the centuries when, let's say, women were not allowed to wear pants or voting or, you know, driving a car at some point, or people were not allowed to travel or more. So were just the basic right to education. And now we have these rights and freedoms, not everywhere equally, but the changes happened and we should not stop now. We should still try and go forward, because if we stop, then it means the end. So what's the purpose? So yeah, don't give up to everyone. And yeah, I hope that will help more people to engage into the digital rights sector and be helpful for everyone. That's it.
Thank you for being a part of this conversation and joining our global community of listeners. Here at Insight Myanmar Podcast, we see our platform as a space where stories, reflections, and experiences come together to create deeper understanding and foster meaningful connections. Each conversation is an invitation to strengthen the ties that reveal our shared humanity, which is grounded in a sense of care towards Myanmar and its people. And this work is made possible only through the generosity and support of listeners like you. Your contributions enable us to continue amplifying these voices, sharing these important stories, and connecting us all through the power of dialogue. And so by giving, you're not just supporting a production, you're actively nurturing a growing community of insight and compassion. So if you found value in what we share, we invite you to help us sustain and expand this platform. Every donation, no matter the size, helps us to keep this effort alive. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to make a contribution and be a part of the shared journey.
Oh, ba, yara nanda, yara nanga, 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 yara nanga